Lecture 24, Buddhism in America.
As the story of Buddhism has unfolded over the course of these lectures, we've seen that Buddhism is an extraordinarily malleable and adaptable tradition. I think we can agree on that. The Buddhist tradition has changed so much that we would have to say one of its primary characteristics is its flexibility, its downright changeableness. It's made it pretty elusive for us, pretty challenging, but also pretty elusive and difficult for us to pin down exactly what it is that's Buddhist about each one of the movements that we've seen. From India, its homeland, it spread into just about every corner of Asia. And it transformed the civilizations it encountered, while it too was being transformed in ways that would, I think, have been unimaginable to its earliest practitioners. It should come as no surprise to us to see that in the last chapter, or at least the last that we're able to witness, Buddhism today has become an influential part of the culture throughout Europe and the Americas. In this final lecture, we're going to consider some of the ways Buddhism has entered Western culture, and we also will consider some of the ways this encounter has changed the Buddhist tradition itself. The first serious scholarly contacts between Europeans and the Buddhists of South and Southeast Asia took place during the 19th century. As European colonial officials attempted to study, as you can imagine, the culture of this inchoate colonial population that they were attempting to gather some knowledge of. An early precursor of this movement, who is a hero for me and is a hero for many scholars who work in this field, was a brilliant British colonial officer by the name of William Jones, Sir William Jones, who was known as Oriental Jones to his contemporaries. Jones helped institutionalize the study of Sanskrit. And what that means, I mean, really, this may sound funny to you as a way to start out the discussion of all of this, but this was a big deal. This is the guy who first was able, as a European, to come to some understanding of the classical languages of India and begin to make those languages known. This is important, especially for the study of Buddhism, because Buddhism itself had died in India. It wasn't accessible simply through the contemporary culture. Jones made it possible for people to study the Sanskrit language, to write scholarly articles about it, and to begin to dig into the history in the way that we have been doing here in these last few lectures. So we are, in lots of ways, the heirs of this great scholar. Another important intellectual precursor for the kind of study that we've been doing was a great 19th century French scholar of Buddhism by the name of Eugène Burnouf. He wrote L'Introduction à l'Histoire du Bouddhisme Indien, published in Paris in 1844. And I am happy to say, because I love relics, that I have taken an original copy of this out of Widener Library and held it in my hand. This great artifact, this great milestone in the study of Buddhism in the West. Burnouf's book made Mahayana Buddhism available to people like Henry David Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson, the great transcendentalist authors and philosophers in Concord, Massachusetts. And through them, also independently, he made it available to many people who were interested in the study of Asia throughout the 19th century. And out of Burnouf's example came a remarkable tradition of European scholarship, especially French and Belgian scholarship about Buddhism in the late 19th century and in the early 20th century. So a lot of what we're able to say, quite frankly, about the early history of Buddhism came from these great European scholars, from Jones originally, the British colonial official in India, and Burnouf, who helped open up the textual tradition of Mahayana Buddhism to us and introduce us to texts like the Lotus Sutra and Nagarjuna and all of those other key historical artifacts that have been important in our understanding of Buddhism in this course. Another important European and American contact with the Buddhist world took place at the end of the 19th century, and this is one that helped Europeans and Americans get to know the Buddhist tradition in a certain way, but also rather remarkably shaped the development of Buddhism for good or ill in the 20th century. In 1880, the end of the 19th century, a woman by the name of Madame Blavatsky and one of her sidekicks, a man named Colonel Henry Steele Olcott, who were the founders of the American Theosophical Society, traveled to Ceylon and they converted to Buddhism. They accepted the teaching of the Buddha, they took the three refuges and converted to Buddhism, and then promptly began to interpret Buddhism for a Western audience, and not incidentally also to interpret Buddhism for the people in Ceylon. Now, if you can imagine yourself in the situation that they encountered in Ceylon in those days, traditional Sri Lankan Buddhism or Sinhalese Buddhism was very much on the defensive. British colonial influence was quite strong. There wasn't a tremendous amount of respect for an ancient tradition like the practice of Buddhism in Ceylon. And it was a bit unclear, frankly, how Buddhist teaching was going to be organized and presented in a way that would allow it to answer some of the criticisms that were coming from these colonial officers. Christian missionaries were in Ceylon, and they found a lot about the Buddhist tradition that they were concerned about, and that became the focus of their criticism, and it wasn't clear to Buddhist officials in Ceylon exactly how they would respond. Olcott and Blavatsky, particularly Olcott, gave an idiom and gave a style for the presentation of Buddhism that not only responded to these criticisms, but also made it possible for Buddhism to be taught in an aggressive and positive way to a Western audience. So Olcott, bless his heart, remarkable figure that he was, organized thinking about the Buddhist tradition in the 19th century in a way that allowed Buddhism to reach out to the rest of the world. How did he do this? Well, he published a document that was called a Buddhist catechism. Sounds a little funny now. You wouldn't use those words, really, to present Buddhism in the 20th or 21st centuries, but to Olcott, sounded like a pretty good way to go about laying out the basic teachings of the Buddhist tradition. And in that Buddhist catechism, he put a particular spin on the Buddhist tradition that lingers today in many presentations of Buddhist view of the world. First of all, he criticized what he called superstitious rituals and devil dancing. All of these ancient Buddhist rituals in Ceylon that had to do with the worship of the gods, especially at remote shrines in the island where people went to confront the power of the local deities and to invoke their aid to deal with some of the complex issues of ordinary life, like bringing in a fruitful harvest or fending off the power of a ghost that seemed to be haunting the villages. Olcott said that none of this was real Buddhism. He said that all of this had been a kind of superstitious overlay on the top of the traditional practice of Buddhism as it was presented in the old scriptural texts that were attributable to the Buddha himself. And he thought all of that stuff ought to be junked, just simply thrown away as being inauthentic Buddhism. He also criticized a slavish dependence on authority, not just the authority of human figures, but also the authority of the deities that had been part of this worldview in traditional Ceylon. For him, Buddhism had to do with self-reliance, achieving nirvana for yourself in your own experience. So he emphasized the aspect of Buddhism that we have talked about a little bit in our own discussion of the tradition, right from the very beginning. The idea that the Buddha was concerned about teaching a direct experience of liberation for you right now. Not dependence on some external authority, not dependence on some hope for a future life, but simply a direct knowledge of the experience of nirvana in your own life today. Now, Olcott thought of this in a distinctively modern way. What he was concerned about was constructing a form of Buddhism that he could present to the world, not just in Ceylon, but also to the world at large, as being scientific, pragmatic, down-to-earth, and experiential. This vision of Buddhism is sometimes said these days to be a form of Protestant Buddhism. And the reason for that is that Olcott himself was the son of a Protestant preacher. And he brought a certain kind of Protestant vision to what religion ought to be that he, of course, found in Buddhism, but he also enhanced in Buddhism in order to make it accessible and effective in its presentation to a Western audience. We've seen that. See it today in the teaching of the Dalai Lama, and you'll see it quite often, actually, if you pursue Buddhism outside this course into contemporary literature about the way the tradition applies to the issues of modern life. Now, all of this took place from a European and American perspective over there on the other side of the world. Ceylon is not a place that for many people at the end of the 19th century you would normally think of ever visiting. You didn't rub shoulders with people from Ceylon all that often. But Buddhism came much closer to home in an event that has had tremendous effect on the history of Asian religions, especially in Northern America. American perceptions of Asian religions were radically transformed by an event that was called the World Parliament of Religions in Chicago in 1893. When religious leaders were brought from all over the world into a great confab in Chicago to present their teaching, to discuss their teaching with one another, and begin to make all of these traditions available in an American environment. In retrospect, we can look back on that time as the beginning in a number of different religious traditions of active missionary activity, active missionary projects by people from the Hindu tradition, from the Buddhist tradition, bringing their faith and making it accessible to an American audience. This parliament brought a number of charismatic Buddhist leaders from Asia, including Anagarika Dharmapala, who was a Theravada Buddhist from Ceylon, been very strongly influenced by Olcott's vision of a modern experiential form of Buddhism. And at the parliament, a Rinzai Zen master by the name of Soyen Shaku met an author and German emigre who lived in the Chicago area by the name of Paul Karas, who helped him. The chain of causes here is a little complicated, but Karas helped Soyen Shaku bring to America a young scholar by the name of Daisetsu Suzuki to help propagate Zen. Suzuki became an extraordinarily eloquent and prolific writer about Zen, and for many people in America, especially in the 20th century, especially in the early years of the 20th century, Suzuki was the avenue into Zen. He gave that first vision of the tradition that made the Zen tradition so appealing to so many people in the American audience. After the World Parliament of Religions, Asian Buddhists in North America took steps to organize their own religious communities in ways that they hadn't before. These communities have continued to flourish as the religious and ethnic makeup of American society has become more and more diverse. This happened particularly in the 1960s when American immigration laws changed and it was possible for people from Vietnam, from Thailand, from the countries of Southeast Asia and other places in Asia to immigrate to this country in larger numbers than they ever had been able to do before. A particularly venerable and successful Asian community is the organization of Jodo Shinshu Buddhists on the West Coast, known as the Buddhist Churches of America. I've mentioned them several times, and I'm happy to say that know them reasonably well and have come very much to respect the work that they do, making the tradition of Pure Land devotion available in an American context, but also adapting it to American needs in a way that make it a truly American form of Buddhism. If you ever get a chance to visit one of their temples, it's really a wonderful experience. You'll be intrigued by how much they look and feel like an ordinary American religious organization. I often visit the temple in San Jose when I'm out on the West Coast, and I'm always intrigued by all the energy that goes into the Buddhist Boy Scout troop and the Girl Scout troop and all the funny little cartoons that are up on the secretary's wall. It always feels to me a little bit like the churches and the synagogues and the temples that I know that are more familiar in to the American religious imagination. It's a tradition that has become fully part, I think, of the enormously complex and varied religious scene that we all enjoy. Another intriguing example of Chinese Buddhism in America, which would say an intriguing example of this larger East Asian complex of Buddhism, is the Shilai Temple in Los Angeles, a place that has achieved a certain amount of notoriety in recent years because of the visit that Vice President Al Gore made to the Shilai Temple that got him into so much hot water in his fundraising activities. Shilai Temple represents a particularly active and distinctive form of Mahayana Buddhism. It comes originally from Taiwan, and it too is a large and visible and significant part of this varied Buddhist environment in North America. And if you look closely enough, you can find comparable diversity among Buddhists from other parts of Asia, including Buddhists from Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Tibet, Mongolia, Korea, too. You know, Korea is a lively and active Buddhist country, or at least it has a lively and active Buddhist component in its culture. Unfortunately, we haven't had the time to discuss it in detail, but it too should always be remembered when you think about the possible variety of Buddhism that's available here in North America, and sometimes in extraordinarily surprising ways. I mean, I would love to tell you story after story, if I could, about Buddhists in America and some of the odd ways they cross the different cultures that they embody. One particular story I will allow myself to tell you is a story of a young Kalmuk Mongol guy who grew up in a working class section of Philadelphia and became interested in Tibetan Buddhism. He used to travel with his parents to go and visit a Tibetan monastery in New Jersey. He was kind of fascinated by this as a kid, so he asked his parents whether there was any way for him to study a little bit more of this. And they said, well, yeah, sure. Why don't we send you to India and let you be trained as a Tibetan monk in one of the Tibetan refugee communities in South India? He went on over there, and he showed a certain aptitude, shall we say, for what he was learning. And after a period of time, the members of the monastery went back. I don't know if they went through their records or went through their own memories and discerned that he was the reincarnation indeed of an important Mongolian monk from a previous generation. So he was studying there, minding his own business, being a teenager, being a kid, and the Soviet Union broke up. A republic was created, the Republic of Kalmukia. And the call went out to the Dalai Lama, do you have a Kalmuk Mongol monk who could serve as the minister of religious affairs in our new republic? The Dalai Lama went through his Rolodex, and sure enough, there was the name of this young guy from Philadelphia. So he was recruited by the Dalai Lama and sent on up to serve as the minister of religious affairs in the Kalmuk Republic. Quite remarkable, I would have to say. It's an extraordinary trajectory for a young Buddhist to go all the way from Philadelphia through South India into this position in the bureaucracy in the Kalmuk Republic. I'm not sure exactly how he likes it, but I won't try to speak for him. I'll have to let him speak for himself. That's simply an example, And there are many stories of these complex trajectories that cross different cultural and ethnic lines. Now, as Buddhism has spread across North America, it seems that just about every variety of Asian Buddhism has also been adapted for an American audience, for a white Anglo audience. Zen centers were established in several places in North America, making it possible for American converts to receive training and assume positions of leadership. A Roshi by the name of Shunryu Suzuki established the San Francisco Zen Center and trained a number of important disciples, including Richard Baker Roshi, who have had a lot of influence on the spread of Zen. Yasutani Roshi, another Japanese Zen master, traveled widely in America and trained several disciples who went on to organize major Zen centers of their own. So Zen has moved in an organized way through American culture and now is found in organized Zen centers quite widely in North America. The movement that is known as Soka Gakkai has brought Nichiren's teaching of devotion to the Lotus Sutra and to a broad range of American audiences. As I mentioned last time, it's particularly influential in the African-American community in this country. So when I talk about white Anglo-American Buddhists, that's really a misnomer, truth be told. We're talking about a lot more diverse community amongst American Buddhists than merely these white faces that sometimes populate the audience in Zen centers across the country. Tibetan Buddhism has been represented by all four major schools, the Nyingma tradition, the Gelugpa, the Sakya, and the Kagyu, and many, many sub-varieties. Among some of the important communities of Tibetan Buddhism in America are two that I happen to have experienced and benefited from. There could be many more that I could cite for you. One was Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche's Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado, founded in the mid-70s in the midst of a great explosion of countercultural energy. Eventually, it's become institutionalized and is now one of the most active and important Buddhist educational institutions in America. I just noticed in the New York Times a couple of days ago that their great stupa enshrining the relics of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche has been dedicated in Red Feather Lakes, Colorado. Put that, too, on the list of places you ought to visit to understand or to encounter Buddhist holy sites in the world. In the article about this, the dedication of this stupa, the author quotes Judith Simmer Brown, who is a good friend and chairwoman of the Naropa Institute's Religious Studies Department. And she says that it seems to her, in the 1970s, Buddhism was more of a sect. That's speaking about the Buddhism in the Naropa Institute back there in the 70s. But by creating monuments like the one that they've created in Colorado, Buddhism is moving to become more of a culture and a civilization. So her understanding is that Buddhism is now expanding in such a way that it is becoming in itself a major component in the larger culture and part of the complex fabric of American civilization. Another important Tibetan community in the East was Geshe Wangyal's Gelugpa Meditation Center in Washington, New Jersey. Geshe Wangyal was a Mongolian monk and is not terribly well known in his own right, but he trained many very important American disciples who have had a lot of impact on the academic study of Tibetan Buddhism. So you can trace many important lineages back to the teaching that he gave in that quiet monastery up in the mountains in New Jersey. I spent many wonderful afternoons studying at his feet, coming to know the Tibetan philosophical tradition. I was simply one small part of the large movement that he helped bring into existence in that place. But all of this, of course, has to do with specific sectarian movements associated with the Buddhist tradition in America. If you want to talk about American Buddhist, about the influence of Buddhism in America, and also, for that matter, in the rest of the world as well, you need to talk about the way Buddhism has insinuated itself into other cultural movements, into the arts, into literature, into film, into music. I particularly am fond of talking with my students at Boston University about Buddhist literary texts, expressions of the Buddhist tradition in contemporary literature, because it often is through books, through literature, that people come to know the Buddhist tradition for the first time. One text that we read with pleasure, it's been important in a lot of people, in the way a lot of people have understood the Buddhist tradition, is Jack Kerouac's novel, The Dharma Bums, or Jack Kerouac's On the Road. He had a certain kind of intuitive, popular sense of what the practice of Buddhism was, and he made it available to people who wouldn't know anything about Buddhism in a technical way. So it was an important introduction, an important entry point for a lot of people who encountered Buddhism in the 70s and in the 80s. Another important text that really takes us to the European world rather than to the world of North America is Hermann Hesse's novel, Siddhartha. Very important modernist vision of the Buddhist tradition. As you know, if you've read that novel, Siddhartha is the hero of the text, but he's not the Buddha. He has the Buddha's name, but as the story of the text unfolds, Siddhartha renounces his palace, of course. He wouldn't be on the Buddhist path if he didn't do that. And then he encounters the Buddha and decides that he has to achieve awakening for himself, not by following the path that's taught to him by the Buddha. And he goes off on a long and circuitous journey to try to come to some kind of awakening that responds to the demands, the questions, the problems of his own experience. This gives a distinctively modern spin to the relationship between contemporary experience and the traditional teaching of Buddhism. And it, too, has been an important entry point for people into Buddhist experience. There's another novelist that I want to mention to you that I think would be fascinating for many of you to explore. I don't think he's as well known as Hermann Hesse or Jack Kerouac, but he's somebody who deserves, in my opinion, to be put right up there in the pantheon of great Buddhist novelists. This is a guy by the name of Charles Johnson. He's written a couple of remarkable novels about African-American experience, one called The Ox Herding Tale, another one called The Middle Passage. They're narratives about people who have escaped from slavery or who were ex-slaves and managed to put that phase in their experience behind them in some fashion. And it explores all of the implications of that change of consciousness that takes place when that experience of bondage is left behind. I'm so struck by the way Buddhism weaves its way through his experience of these historical dilemmas, particularly the experiences of enlightenment that he often recounts at the very end of his novels. All I can do in this lecture is simply tease you with that suggestion, but I suggest to you, if you want to explore the Buddhist tradition in contemporary literature, Charles Johnson's novels are a remarkable and challenging place to do that, and one where you'll be confronted by a vision of Buddhism that is surprising and extraordinarily profound. Now, as I ring the changes on all of these different varieties of Buddhism that are present in North America and also in comparable ways throughout the rest of the contemporary world, you have to be struck by the extraordinary flexibility and variety of this tradition. And he asked the question, I suppose, at the end of our study, if Buddhism is so flexible, if it's so malleable, if it's so diverse, What is it in the end that has made it so attractive to so many people for 2,500 years and continues to make it so attractive today? Well, I'm convinced that there are really two answers to this question, two answers that we can use to conclude our study of this tradition. I think you can say, with some confidence, I'm convinced of this, that the appeal of Buddhism lies somewhere in the structure of the Four Noble Truths, that basic statement of Buddhist teaching, between the conviction that everyone suffers and the conviction that there is a way to bring that suffering decisively to an end. All Buddhists struggle in one way or another with this question. It's the great question of human life, and I think people have been fascinated by the way Buddhists challenge them to think in new ways about this basic issue. And then the second thing, the last thing that I think is a source of appeal in the Buddhist tradition. It's simply these extraordinary stories, all the different ways people have lived out the example of the Buddha in their own lives in extraordinarily different ways. We've encountered a few of those stories. I hope you've been fascinated by them. I hope they have in some way become part of your story, your own emerging story as you tell the story of your own lives and grapple with some of the issues that the Buddha grappled with 2,500 years ago. In any case, I certainly have enjoyed telling you some of these stories, and I appreciate all the attention that you've given to me in this course of lectures. Thank you very much.
We hope you've enjoyed these lectures from our Great Courses series. Our courses are now available to order online. Visit our website at www.teach12.com or call our customer service representatives at 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Thank you very much.